This is the end of the book. One of my favorite stories. Also, the last introduction. Peculiar thing about these introductions, they began as simply random notes on theme in my first collection. Then, as the years have passed, they have become more and more important, more integrated with what I've been trying to say in my fiction. The response to them is mixed. There are reviewers and critics and fans who think the stories should be thrown out and the introductions kept, perhaps an entire book of bibble, bibble, bibble. There is another faction that hates me so much personally they cannot stand the intrusion of my personality. The stories, they don't seem to mind much, though they contend I'm a poor, lousy hack with a tiny gift for explosiveness. But the intros drive them cockeyed. They pray that either I stop writing prefaces or lightning strikes me in the spleen. There are some who enjoy the totality, who think they get more for their money and their enjoyment with this additional material specially written for a book. And there are the vast multitudes who think the entire item ought to be burned as it comes off the presses. There are even a couple of people in Pocatello who've never heard of me, but mostly they just stand around looking at the sky hoping to see another of them great silver birds go fly, fly to the sunset. Suffice it to say, I enjoy writing these little writer-to-reader liaisons, so get used to it, troops. Relief is nowhere in sight. But sometimes, the background of a story is almost more interesting than the yarn I made from it. Take this story, for instance. Maggie lives. She is a tall blonde in Los Angeles. I never quite got her into bed, though it was close. I had dated her sporadically for a year or so back in 1963 and then lost track of her. Then when Joseph E. Levine flew the cast and production people of the Oscar to Las Vegas for Tony Bennett's opening at the Riviera in conjunction with the film in which Tony was appearing, I met her again. It was very late. Everybody else had either gone to bed or picked up some action or were gambling. I was sitting alone at the blackjack table in my tuxedo when a hand was laid on my shoulder. I turned around, and it was, whoops, I almost called her by her real name. It was Maggie. She was in the chorus line at one of the hotels, and I suspect she was hooking on the side. We talked, and she invited me home with her, but it stirred up all sorts of remembrances of the chick, and most particularly the bedroom and bathroom of her apartment in Los Angeles. Strange that I would think of that at that moment, but I remembered vividly walking into the bedroom the first time I came to pick her up. Everything was plush red velvet, like a New Orleans whorehouse. The bathroom fixtures were gold dolphins spewing out water. There was a frantic need to be elegant for this girl. She had come from simple beginnings, and class was her goal in this life. Somehow, seeing her again in Vegas, she fitted the town more precisely than anyone else I'd ever met. I hate Vegas. It represents a physical manifestation of evil in this country, for my money. None of which I lose at the tables, incidentally. I'm phenomenally lucky. But she fit. Not that she was evil, just that she was right for the town. A product of the times. So I suddenly had the alarming experience of my intellect getting the better of my gonads, and I turned down her offer of bed service. Because all at once, in a total presence of structure, the story that follows popped into my head. I bid her a suave adieu and dashed up to my room in the Riviera. I had my typewriter with me. I always have my typewriter with me. I stripped down naked, which is the way I write frequently, and started writing the story. Between getting dressed and dashing downstairs to bug the casino manager for facts and specifics on slot machines, and incidentally, everything in this story is accurate, and sitting directly in the line of the air conditioning, by morning, the story was half finished, and I had pleurisy. I went into a coma later that day, and they had to fly my unconscious carcass back to L.A., where I went into a hospital. When I got out, I finished the yarn. I've seen Maggie several times since, but by now she is so firmly entrenched in my thinking as the character of the story that I could no more bring myself to lay her than I could to revisit Vegas. Both are deadly, and the further away from each of them I stay, the better. A note on style before I go. I've tried in this story to give a sense of the immediacy, the wham-bang, thank you, ma'am, of Vegas. The style I've employed is pure concussion, but I scream helplessly at the inadequacies of the lineal medium. There is a section herein by which I try to convey a sense of impression of the moment of death. In films, I could use effects. In type on paper, it comes down to the enormously ineffectual italics, type tricks, staccato sentences, and spacings of a man groping to expand his medium. Bear with me, it is experimentation, and unless typesetters and editors somehow develop the miracle talent of letting writers tear the form apart and reassemble it in their individual ways, the best I'll be able to do in terms of freedom and impact is what I got away with here in Pretty Maggie Money Eyes. With an 8-hole card and a queen showing, with the dealer showing a 4-up, Costner decided to let the house do the work. So he stood, and the dealer turned up, 6. The dealer looked like something out of a 1935 George Raft film. Arctic diamond chip eyes, manicured fingers long as a brain surgeon's, straight black hair slicked flat away from the pale forehead. He didn't look up as he peeled them off. A 3, another 3, bam, 5, bam, 21. And Costner saw his last $30, 6 $5 chips, scraped on the edge of the cards into the dealer's chip racks. Busted. Flat. Down and out in Las Vegas, Nevada, playground of the Western world. He slid off the comfortable stool chair and turned his back on the blackjack table. The action was already starting again, like waves closing over a drowned man. He had been there, was gone, and no one had noticed. No one had seen a man blow the last tie with salvation. Costner now had his choice. He could bum his way into Los Angeles and try to find something that resembled a new life, or he could go blow his brains out through the back of his head. Neither choice showed much light or sense. He thrust his hands deep into the pockets of his worn and dirty chinos and started away down the line of slot machines clanging and rattling on the other side of the aisle between blackjack tables. He stopped. He felt something in his pocket. Beside him, but all engrossed, a 50-ish matron in electric lavender capris, high heels, and ship-and-shore blouse was working 2 slots, loading and pulling one while waiting for the other to clock down. She was dumping quarters in a seemingly inexhaustible supply from a Dixie cup held in her left hand. There was a surrealistic presence to the woman. She was almost automated. Not a flicker of expression on her face, the eyes fixed and unwavering. Only when the gong rang, someone down the line had pulled a jackpot, did she look up. And at that moment, Costner knew what was wrong and immoral and deadly about Vegas, about legalized gambling, about setting the traps all baited and open in front of the average human. The woman's face was gray with hatred, envy, lust, and dedication to the game. In that timeless instant when she heard another drugged soul down the line winning a minuscule jackpot. A jackpot that would only lull the player with words like luck and ahead of the game. The jackpot lure. The sparkling, bobbling, many-colored wiggler in a sea of poor fish. The thing in Costner's pocket was a silver dollar. He brought it out and looked at it. The eagle was hysterical. But Costner pulled to an abrupt halt, only 1/2 footstep from the sign indicating the limits of Tap City. He was still with it. What the high rollers called the edge, the vigorish, that fine hole card, 1 buck, 1 cartwheel. Pulled out of the pocket not half as deep as the pit into which Costner had just been about to plunge. What the hell, he thought, and turned to the row of slot machines. He had thought they'd all been pulled out of service, the silver dollar slots. A shortage of coinage, said the United States Mint. But right there, side by side with the nickel and quarter bandits, was one cartwheel machine. $2,000 jackpot. Costner grinned foolishly. If you're gonna go out like a champ. He thumbed the silver dollar into the coin slot and grabbed the heavy, oiled handle. Shining cast aluminum and pressed steel. Big black plastic ball angled for arm ease. Pull it all day and you won't get weary. Without a prayer in the universe, Costner pulled the handle. She had been born in Tucson, mother full-blooded Cherokee, father a bindle stiff on his way through. Mother had been working a trucker's stop. Father had popped for Spencer steak and sides. Mother had just gotten over a bad scene, indeterminate origins, unsatisfactory culminations. Mother had popped for bed and sides. Margaret Annie Jessie had come 9 months later, black of hair, fair of face, and born into a life of poverty. 23 years later, a determined product of Miss Clairol and Berlitz, a dream image formed by Vogue and intimate association with the rat race, Margaret Annie Jessie had become a contraction. Maggie. Long legs, trim and cultish, hips a trifle large, the kind that promote that specific thought in men about getting their hands around them. Belly flat, isometrics. Waist cut to the bone, a waist that works in any style from dirndl to disco slacks. No breasts, all nipple, but no breast, like an expensive whore, the way O'Hara pinned it. And no padding. Forget the cans, baby. There's other more important action. Smooth, Michelangelo-sculpted neck, a pillar, proud, and all that face. Outthrust chin, perhaps a tot too much belligerence, but if you'd walloped as many gropers, you too, sweetheart. Narrow mouth, petulant lower lip, nice to chew on, a lower lip as though filled with honey, bursting, ready for things to happen. A nose that threw the right sort of shadow, flaring nostrils. The acceptable words, aquiline, patrician, classic, all of that. Cheekbones as stark and promontory as a spit of land after 10 years of open ocean. Cheekbones holding darkness like narrow shadows, sooty beneath the taut fleshed bone structure, amazing cheekbones, the whole face, really. An ancient kingdom's up-tilted eyes, the touch of the Cherokee, eyes that looked out at you as you looked in at them like someone peering out of the keyhole as you peered in. Actually, dirty eyes. They said, you can get it. Blonde hair. A great deal of it, wound and rolled and smoothed and flowing, in the old style, the page boy thing men always admire. No tight little cap of slicked plastic, no ratted and teased Annapurna of bizarre coiffure, no ironed flat discotheque hair like number 3 flat noodles. Hair the way a man wants it, so he can dig his hands in at the base of the neck and pull all that face very close. An operable woman, a working mechanism, a rigged and sudden machinery of softness and motivation. 23, and determined as hell never to abide in that veil of poverty her mother had called purgatory for her entire life. Snuffed out in a grease fire in their last trailer somewhere in Arizona, thank God no more pleas for a little money from baby girl Maggie, hustling drinks in a Los Angeles topless joint. There ought to be some remorse in there somewhere for a mommy gone where all the good grease fire victims go. Look around. You'll find it. Maggie. Genetic freak. Mommy's Cherokee up-tilted eye shape and Pollock quick-screwing daddy without a name's blue as innocence color. Blue-eyed Maggie. Dyed blonde. All of that face. All of that leg. $50 a night can get it, and it sounds like it's having a climax. Irish innocent, blue-eyed innocent, French-legged innocent Maggie, Polack, Cherokee, Irish, all woman and going on the market for this month's rent on the stucco pad, $80 worth of groceries, a couple months' worth for a Mustang, 3 appointments with the specialist in Beverly Hills about that shortness of breath after a night on the hustle bump, the sticky thigh, the disco lurch, the gotcha sweat. Woman minutes, increments under the meat, perspiration purchases. Yeah, it does. Maggie, Maggie, Maggie. Pretty Maggie Money Eyes, who came from Tucson and trailers and rheumatic fever and a surge to live that was all kaleidoscope frenzy of clawing, scrabbling, no nonsense. If it took lying on one's back and making sounds like a panther in the desert, then one did it, because nothing, but nothing, was as bad as being dirt poor, itchy-skinned, soiled underwear, scuff-toed, hairy and ashamed, lousy with the no-guts. Nothing. Maggie, hooker, hustler, grabber, swinger. If there's a buck in it, there's rhythm, and the onomatopoeia is Maggie, Maggie, Maggie. She who puts out, for a price, whatever that might be. Maggie was dating Nuncio. He was Sicilian. He had dark eyes and an alligator grain wallet with slip-in pockets for credit cards. He was a spender, a sport, a high roller. They went to Vegas. Maggie and the Sicilian. Her blue eyes and his slip-in pockets. But mostly, her blue eyes. The spinning reels behind the 3 long glass windows blurred, and Costner knew there wasn't a chance. $2,000 jackpot. Round and round, whirring. 3 bells or 2 bells and a jackpot bar get 18. 3 plums or 2 plums and a jackpot bar get 14. 3 oranges or 2 oranges and a jack... 10, 5, $2 for a single cherry cluster in first position. Something. I'm drowning. Something. The whirring. Round and round. And something happened that wasn't considered in the pit boss manual. The reels whipped and snapped to a stop. Clank, clank, clank. Tight in place. 3 bars looked up at Costner, but they didn't say jackpot. They were 3 bars from which stared 3 blue eyes. Very blue, very immediate, very jackpot. 20 silver dollars clattered into the payoff trough at the bottom of the machine. An orange light popped on in the casino cashier's cage, bright orange on the jackpot board, and the gong began clanging overhead. The slot machine floor manager nodded once to the pit boss, who pursed his lips and started toward the seedy-looking man still standing with his hand on the slot's handle. The token payment, 20 silver dollars, lay untouched in the payoff trough. The balance of the jackpot, $1,980, would be paid manually by the casino cashier, and Costner stood dumbly as the 3 blue eyes stared up at him. There was a moment of idiotic disorientation as Costner stared back at the 3 blue eyes, a moment in which the slot machine's mechanisms registered to themselves, and the gong was clanging furiously. All through the hotel's casino, people turned from their games to stare. At the roulette tables, the white-on-white players from Detroit and Cleveland pulled their watery eyes away from the clattering ball and stared down the line for a second at the ratty-looking guy in front of the slot machine. From where they sat, they couldn't tell it was a 2 grand pot, and their rheumy eyes went back into billows of cigar smoke and that little ball. The blackjack hustlers turned momentarily, screwing around in their seats, and smiled. They were closer to the slot players in temperament, but they knew the slots were a dodge to keep the old ladies busy while the players worked toward their endless 21s. And the old dealer, who could no longer cut it at the fast action boards, who had been put out to pasture by a grateful management, standing at the Wheel of Fortune near the entrance to the casino, even he paused in his zombie murmuring, "Another winner on a Wheel of Fortune," to no one at all, and looked toward Costner and that incredible gong clanging. Then, in a moment, still with no players, he called another non-existent winner. Costner heard the gong from far away. It had to mean he had won $2,000, but that was impossible. He checked the payoff chart on the face of the machine. Three bars labeled jackpot meant jackpot, $2,000. But these three bars did not say jackpot. They were three gray bars, rectangular in shape, with a blue eye directly in the center of each bar. Blue eyes? Somewhere, a connection was made, and electricity, a billion volts of electricity, shot through Costner. His hair stood on end, his fingertips bled raw, his eyes turned to jelly, and every fiber in his musculature became radioactive. Somewhere, out there, in a place that was not this place, Costner had been inextricably bound to someone. Blue eyes? The gong had faded out of his head, the constant noise level of the casino, chips chittering, people mumbling, dealers calling plays. It had all gone, and he was embedded in silence. Tied to that someone else, out there somewhere, through those three blue eyes. Then, in an instant, it had passed, and he was alone again, as though released by a giant hand, the breath crushed out of him. He staggered up against the slot machine. "You all right, fella?" A hand gripped him by the arm, steadied him. The gong was still clanging overhead somewhere, and he was breathless from a journey he had just taken. His eyes focused, and he found himself looking at the stocky pit boss who had been on duty while he had been playing blackjack. "Yeah, I'm okay, just a little dizzy is all."
"Sounds like you got yourself a big jackpot, fella."
The pit boss grinned. It was a leathery grin, something composed of stretched muscles and conditioned reflexes, totally mirthless.
"Yeah, great."
Costner tried to grin back, but he was still shaking from that electrical absorption that had kidnapped him.
"Let me check it out,"
the pit boss was saying, edging around Costner and staring at the face of the slot machine.
"Yeah, three jackpot bars. All right, you're a winner."
Then it dawned on Costner. $2,000. He looked down at the slot machine and saw three bars with the word jackpot on them. No blue eyes, just words that meant money. Costner looked around frantically. Was he losing his mind? From somewhere, not in the casino, he heard a tinkle of rhodium-plated laughter. He scooped up the 20 silver dollars. The pit boss dropped another cartwheel into the chief and pulled the jackpot off. Then the pit boss walked him to the rear of the casino, talking to him in a muted, extremely polite tone of voice. At the cashier's window, the pit boss nodded to a weary-looking man at a huge Rolodex card file checking credit ratings.
"Barney, jackpot on the cartwheel chief, slot 50015.
He grinned at Costner, who tried to smile back. It was difficult. He felt stunned. The cashier checked a payoff book for the correct amount to be drawn and leaned over the counter toward Costner.
"Check or cash, sir?"
Costner felt buoyancy coming back to him.
"Is the casino's check good?"
They all three laughed at that.
"A check's fine," Costner said.
The check was drawn, and the check writer punched out the little bumps that said 2,000.
"The 20 cartwheels are a gift," the cashier said, sliding the check through to Costner.
He held it, looked at it, and still found it difficult to believe. 2 grand.
back on the Golden Road. As he walked back through the casino with the pit boss, the stocky man asked pleasantly, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" Costner had to think a moment. He didn't really have any plans, but then the sudden realization came to him. "I'm going to play that slot machine again." The pit boss smiled. A congenital sucker. He would put all 20 of those silver dollars back into the chief and then turn to the other games. Blackjack, roulette, faro, baccarat. In a few hours, he would have redeposited the $2,000 with the hotel casino. It always happened. He walked Costner back to the slot machine and patted him on the shoulder. "Lots of luck, fella." As he turned away, Costner slipped a silver dollar into the machine and pulled the handle. The pit boss had taken only 5 steps when he heard the incredible sound of the reels clicking to a stop, the clash of 20 token silver dollars hitting the payoff trough, and that goddamned gong went out of its mind again. She had known that son of a bitch Nuncio was a perverted swine, a walking filth, a dung heap between his ears, some kind of monster in nylon undershorts. There weren't many kinds of games Maggie hadn't played, but what that Sicilian Desade wanted to do was outright vomity. She nearly fainted when he suggested it. Her heart, which the Beverly Hills specialist had said she should not tax, began whooping frantically. "You pig," she screamed. "You filthy, dirty, ugly pig, you. Nuncio, you pig." She had bounded out of the bed and started to throw on clothes. She didn't even bother with the brassiere, pulling the poor boy's sweater on over her thin breasts, still crimson with the touches and love bites Nuncio had showered on them. He sat up in the bed, a pathetic-looking little man, gray hair at the temples and no hair at all on top, and his eyes were moist. He was porcine, was indeed the swine, she called him, but he was helpless before her. He was in love with his hooker, with the tart whom he was supporting. It had been the first time for the swine Nuncio, and he was helpless. Back in Detroit, had it been a floozy, a bimbo, a chippy broad, he would have gotten out of the double bed and wrapped her around pretty good. But this Maggie, she tied him in knots. He had suggested that, what they should do together, because he was so consumed with her. But she was furious with him. It wasn't that bizarre an idea.
"Give me a chance to talk to you, honey. Maggie."
"You filthy pig, Nuncio. Give me some money. I'm going down to the casino, and I don't want to see your filthy pig face for the rest of the day. Remember that." And she had gone in his wallet and pants and taken $816 while he watched. He was helpless before her. She was something stolen from a world he knew only as class, and she could do what she wanted with him. Genetic freak Maggie. Blue-eyed, posing mannequin Maggie, pretty Maggie Money Eyes, who was one half Cherokee and one half a bunch of other things, had absorbed her lessons well. She was the very model of a class broad. "Not for the rest of the day, do you understand?" She stared at him till he nodded. Then she went downstairs, furious, to fret and gamble and wonder about nothing but years of herself. Men stared after her as she walked. She carried herself like a challenge, the way a squire carried a pennon, the way a prize bitch carried herself in the judge's ring, born to the blue, the wonders of mimicry and desire.